Okay, welcome to yet another talk on Saturday, named after the person who meditated for 24 hours. On Saturday. Okay. So you must have all got up very late this morning, or too early. Never mind. So today, another Dharma talk, and today I'm going to be talking about enlightenment. So those of you who are already enlightened, you can go back to bed now. For those who still want to get enlightened, listen to today's talk. Because when you teach a retreat and you answer these questions, every now and again somebody talks about enlightenment or streamlining and stuff like that. And it's important to find out exactly what it is. Otherwise, it's like you get on Buddha air, as the simile I talked about some time ago, and you're not quite sure where Buddha air is going to land. And that's a very dangerous option. Do you really want to get there? Who knows, Nirvana might be some province in Iraq. And you end up in a place you just don't want to be. So it's important to have a good idea of what Nirvana actually is. And usually in Buddhist centers, in temples, in monasteries or retreats, Nirvana is like the elephant in the room, something which is always really there but no one likes to talk about. And the one reason they don't like to talk about it is because not many people have a clue what it means. But it's important we get some idea and some clear idea, because otherwise that people go around and they get all these mystical sayings about Nirvana. You know, like the ground of all being. Have you heard that one before for Nirvana? Now, what does that mean? I know this ground over here which I'm sitting on. I know ground coffee. But ground of being? So when you really think about that and analyze it, basically there's a group of words we call the mystical words which sound good but actually have no real meaning. They could have been said by some politician like Tony Blair, who was famous for his spin, saying something which sounds good but actually means nothing. And it's actually very fascinating sometimes being around politicians. And actually, I remember the first time, remember the old Premier of Western Australia, Richard Court? I remember this, 24 years ago when I first came here, the Vietnamese group in Money Street, they were opening their temple and they had a big function. And the leader of that group, Mr. Lee, you know, he was old, like 24 years ago, and he's still around, but he's a very, very sharp operator. And Richard Court was there because he was just representing somebody or other, I'm not sure, but he wasn't the premier, he was just a small politician at the time. And Mr. Lee just came up and he said something. It was actually about the, I think, I don't know if it was the leader of the opposition, but it was John Howard at that time, who just blasted migration to Australia. And I know that this Mr. Lee came up and said, and now I would invite Richard Court, who's representing so-and-so on our grand opening, to please explain the words of your leader who said that we shouldn't have any more immigrants here in Australia or something. And it really put Richard Court on the spot. And I was at the table then, he said, I thought this was just a social gathering, not a political gathering, oh dear. And he sort of grumbled to himself. And he got up, and I was listening to what he was saying, and he said something which actually seemed to be saying, oh no, we allow as much immigration as you possibly want. But he said it in such a way, if you listen carefully, he said nothing at all. It was the first time I really heard about political speak. Now how you could actually say something which sounds good, but actually you analyse it and it means absolutely nothing at all. And sometimes I see the same thing when people talk about Nirvana. They're sort of budding politicians who have lost their way and become monks or nuns instead. But but so you've got to give some real definition. Actually, I meant to actually to say, talking about the elephant in the room, because somebody also asked me a question. And I didn't have time to answer. I promised that I would answer yesterday on the talk about obstacles, but I never really did. And that was like the elephant Nilgiri in the strategy. What happens if your defilements are just incredibly strong? And you have what we call in Buddhism. I'll get back to Nibbana in a few moments. I'm not spinning out so that I'm not answering the question. That sometimes, and this happens to everybody every now and again in retreats at other times, you get what we call the attack of all the hindrances. You know, like desire, ill will, restlessness, sloth and torpor and doubt all at the same time. Now, of course, that's impossible, but nevertheless, that's what it seems like. You know, sometimes we think we've got everything and we're going crazy all at the same time. And we just don't know what to do. And the person who asked the question, which was a great question, said, well, should you just let go and let my elephant mind charge all over the place? What if that doesn't work? What is a backup strategy? And it's a good question, because we let go is not just a backup strategy. It's not just one strategy got a backup behind it. That is the backup strategy. That's the last resort of letting go. However, letting go does not work when you are letting go of the wrong thing. So we don't let go of what's out there. We always have to remember to let go of the controller, the one inside of us who's messing everything up. It's this in here we let go of, not what's out there. Which is one of the biggest problems with letting go. People hear that word a lot, especially in Buddhism, meditation, but they don't apply it to the correct area. And a classic example of that is one of the disciples who comes to Nolamara, a Western Australian guy, and he wanted to keep the five precepts. So he took the five precepts. He's full of faith, from now on I'm going to live by the five precepts. But a few weeks later, he was at a business party, and one of his business associates gave him a glass of beer. He said, no, I can't take beer, I'm a Buddhist. And his friend said, a Buddhist, with a big smile on his face. Yeah, Buddhists are great. They all know about letting go. Come on, let go, have a beer. And of course, it was letting go of the wrong thing. So it doesn't mean let go of all your restraints, all your rules, all your responsibilities. It's not letting go of that what's outside. It's letting go of this thing inside, the craving, the wanting, the doing. That's what we let go of. That's what you let go of. Of course, all the crazy elephants, they have to submit to that. Because you're turning off their gas. You're turning off your computer. Not by just pressing the button, by taking out the power source. And everything has to shut down if you take out the power source of all these things, which is called craving, wanting, doing. So what happens with Nalagiri strategy, which I invented? Nalagiri is a very well-known story in the time of the Buddha, when one of the Buddha's enemies, and it doesn't matter how enlightened you are, how compassionate you are, you will always have enemies. It's just part of being a human being. So if you've got an enemy, don't worry about it. So did the Buddha. Nothing wrong with you. Otherwise, there's something wrong with the Buddha. So just accept it. That's in life, you'll have enemies. So the Buddha's enemy was trying to assassinate him. That's a bad idea, trying to assassinate the enemy. It's like trying to assassinate Superman. You know, so they got impenetrable to bullets and to fire, whatever else. But nevertheless, they tried to assassinate the Buddha. And they tried many different ways. In this particular way, they got this elephant, this huge, big elephant, very powerful. And they fed it alcohol and got the elephant drunk. And when the elephants get drunk, they get crazy. And they let the elephant loose on the very path that the Buddha with all his monks were coming on arms round. So there, I don't know if you remember the movie High Noon, is when the baddie and the sheriff were coming together for a shootout. It's like High Noon in Sawati. That's where the Buddha was. The elephant versus the Buddha. And who would be able to draw first? But anyway, the elephant was running towards the Buddha. And all the people were running away because they saw the elephant coming. And they tried to warn the Buddha and the monks. Get away, run away, there's a big mad elephant coming your way. And all the monks, they ran away. Except for that, went up trees apparently. So that made you think about climbing up a tree. Actually, just a similar story to this, not quite the same. Now, in Thailand, you know, when you go on arms round, especially in the northeast, the water buffalo, for some reason, they just do not like monks. It's true. And you see them, what we really reckon, we're not quite sure what the psychology is, but we think maybe the brown robes reminds them of tigers. And then, you know, tigers are very dangerous because it's a similar colour, they can't have very good eyes. But very often, and the water buffalo are very, very calm and peaceful and they're sort of grazing. But every now and again, if the monk passes, they raise their head and you can actually see this is a dangerous moment because sometimes they charge you. And some monks actually get gored by the water buffalo. Water buffalo go crazy. So on this one occasion, we were just coming back to first years of Wat Nanachat, and I was actually carrying Ajahn Sumedho's bowl. It was just the two of us coming back. And this water buffalo charged both of us. So the both of us, you know, were running. And then, my stupidity, Ajahn Sumedho went one way, and I went another way. And of course, he had much better calm than I did, so the water buffalo followed me. That was a bad mistake. But he soon stopped, and I was okay. But this was like, it's quite so terrifying when you get this huge creature just bearing down on you. And I can imagine what it was like with the Buddha and all these monks. You get out of the way as quite fast as you can. And it's a narrow street too. So all the monks, they climbed the trees, you know, they jumped over the walls, they hid. All except one monk. Ananda. And Ananda was the Buddha's attendant. He loved the Buddha. You know, the Buddha was his master. Sometimes I wonder, you know, if I was walking down in the road there and an elephant charged me, Venerable Tapasi, would you stand in front of me? And like an Ananda, say, take me to save my master. Would you do that? No comment. So Ananda sort of stood in front of the Buddha as this mad elephant was charging to protect the life of his master. But you know what the Buddha did? Out of the way, Ananda, I can handle this. It's very sweet of you to do this. But you know, this is not your duel. Not your fight. You got out of the way. So he gently pushed Ananda out of the way, which must have been quite deflating for Ananda. He's one time to be a martyr and go down in history of saving the life of the Buddha, and the Buddha wouldn't allow him to do that. But nevertheless, there was the Buddha facing the elephant, charging towards him. Charging and charging, faster and faster. And what did the Buddha do? Now, in this story, I think you know that the Buddha did have great psychic powers. Huge powers. Because the Buddha. And I reckon, this is not really in the suttas, because I always make a few things up, as you know by now. I reckon that Buddha could have grabbed Nalagiri by the trunk, by the end of the trunk, very quickly, like some kung fu artist. And then whirled the Buddha three times around his head. And thrown him over the Ganges River about 300 kilometers away. He could have done that easily. But he didn't. He wouldn't fight violence with aggression. Instead, what he did was give unconditional loving kindness. Now remember, unconditional. Something like, Nalagiri, the door of my heart is open to you. No matter what you do with me. If you pick me up with your trunk and smash me against the wall, if you trample me under your huge feet, if you squash me to strawberry jam, I will always be kind and love you and forgive you. The door of my heart's open to you. Do with me what you will. With that degree of kindness, that's called unconditional. No expectations, no demands, a complete abandoning. And that is beautiful kindness. Whatever you wish to do, that's fine. And I will always love you and care for you. Now with that degree of loving kindness, according to the story, in a few seconds, the elephant had stopped and was bowing his head in front of the Buddha, and the Buddha was stroking his trunk. There, Nalagiri. There, Nalagiri. And Nalagiri was lapping it all up. If elephants could purr, Nalagiri would have done that. Now, the meaning of that simile, obviously, is when you're attacked, not by an elephant, but your crazy mind, and it's destroying everything in its path, when it's smashing things and trampling all of your happiness and well-being, when you're going out of your mind crazy, what do? Don't try and fight that mind with whatever limited powers you have by trying to stop that mind. You may be able to do that, but that's not the way for enlightenment. Instead, you look at your crazy mind and say, mind, whatever you want to do with me, you can send me to Greylands Hospital. You can send me completely balmy. You can cause me so much pain or whatever, but I'll always love you, mind. The door of my heart's open to you, mind, whatever you do with me. Unconditional acceptance. If I never have another moment of peace for this whole retreat, never mind. I love you, mind. The door of my heart's completely open to you. With unconditional compassion. And then, if you do that, you'll find, in a few seconds, your mad, crazy mind will be standing in front of you, completely still, as you're stroking your mind. There, mind. There, Nimitta. There, Jhana. It's all right. And that's how it works. You try it, but it has to be 100% unconditional. That's how you stop the crazy mind. And it also tells you, this is why it tells us, this is how you deal with the worst of defilements, and actually even the lesser defilements also are even easier to respond to such an attitude. But that shows you what enlightenment is and how you get there. Not with aggression. Not with saying, one day left, enlightenment or bust. I'm going to sit all night, no more sleep, no more namby-pamby, cream puff, ashy and bra, just don't do anything stuff. I am going to get there tonight. I'm going to not move from my seat, even though my bones turn to dust. Even though I'm in extreme agony, I can deal with this. Other people do. I am bigger than this. It's my big chance to become enlightened, because tomorrow I have to go to work. So don't think like that. That's more doing, and that really gets you crazy. Instead we have this wonderful letting go, but not letting go out there. Letting go of this thing which is afraid, which wants to control, which wants to preserve, which is afraid of you growing crazy or being destroyed. We let go of the fear. We let go of the craving. Because enlightenment, third noble truth, is the end of craving. Now, end of craving sounds something you can get your head around, rather than the ground of all being, or the ultimate reality, or the unconditioned, or whatever else people call enlightenment. End of craving. Now, I say you can get your head around that because in this meditation retreat, you may have had moments, maybe many moments, where you've been sitting there and wanted for nothing in the world, just happily content just being here, sitting against the wall, just watching your breath, not wanting to get a nimitta, not wanting to get up and have your lunch, not wanting anything. You've had moments like that. What were they like? It's moments when you've hardly got any craving left at all. Moments of peace. Deep peace. Now you get some understanding of what enlightenment's all about. An ending of craving. Because you know what it feels like when craving starts to disappear. When you have a window, when there's no craving come up, you're perfectly content. Wow, that's the most wonderful feeling in your life. You understand that this is a taste of freedom. So your job is actually to take that taste. It's just like a sample. Like somebody like Bianca is doing the cooking, and she's sort of making some soup and asks you to taste it. Wow, this is really nice. So I'll have the whole meal, thank you. So in these deep meditations, or even ordinary meditation, you get a taste of something really delicious. So once you've got a taste of it, then you want the full meal. So you go deeper into contentment, into the lack of craving, into sort of peace and stillness. Which is why, from the very beginning of this retreat, I said the goal is stillness, samadhi. But really, that stillness of samadhi is a taste. And when that stillness gets stronger and stronger, then that's the fruit, the whole meal, nibbana. A mind, a being, which is still, which doesn't move. Trouble is, But when things don't move, people get very scared. Because when things don't move, they're called dead. It's true. If you're lying down here and think, oh my goodness, she's dead. What do people do to try and prove you're alive? They poke you, they kick you, they sort of, to see if anything's moving. If nothing's moving, they'll send you down off into the hospital. You're dead. That's one of the problems there, that sometimes we don't know the difference between being dead and being in jhana. But as I mentioned the other day to you, it doesn't matter, even if you are in jhana and completely still, and they take you down and cremate you, when you come out the oven afterwards, you'll still be alive and say, hi. Which might shock the person who's doing the burning, but then, you know, you're okay if you're in jhana. So sometimes you may be very, very still. But for many people we call that being dead. And that's one of the scariest things, because when we get very still, it's as if something is dead. You know what that is? You. The ego. This a connection, a very deep connection, not just philosophical, but experiential. Being, existing, is connected to doing things. Which is why when you stop doing things, people say, you're dead. And it's that old story which I wrote about. And this was actually, I saw this with my own eyes, on the walls of the philosophy departments in Cambridge University when I was a student. It was graffiti, but in those days graffiti was very interesting. Some great philosopher or students of the history of philosophy had written these three statements by three famous philosophers, starting off with René Descartes. And we all know he said, I think therefore I am, but he said many other things as well. That's not all he said. You can't become a famous philosopher by just saying one sentence. What he also said was, to do is to be. Doing things creates this thing we call existence. To do is to be. And that became quite a well-known saying amongst the philosophers. But maybe, a couple of hundred years later, you know, the famous French philosopher, Jean-Paul Sartre, like many people do, we turn things around. He said, no, that's not quite correct. It's not to do is to be. It's the other way around. To be is to do things. So from to do is to be, Jean-Paul Sartre turned it around and said, you know, to be is to do. And it was finally summed up once and for all by the very famous American philosopher. Doobie doobie doo. Frank Sinatra. And that was really good graffiti in those years, because that was actually witty and funny. And it was actually meaning something as well. So what Frank Sinatra was pointing out, doing and being were all around each other. And you can't separate them. It's all doobie 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 doo. Because whenever you do something, then you exist. Whenever you exist, you want to do something. Now that's called the wheel of samsara. Doing and being, and doing and being, and doing and being. You'll find, especially when you're young, to exist, to show that your life is. You want to go places and do things. And when you get old and you can't do so much, it is as if you are fading away. And when you get into meditation, and the mind starts to get still, when you're not doing very much, then it's like you're fading away. What the Buddha saw is, doing, actually craving, it comes from this sense of existence, from the sense of a self, a me. And part of this path of enlightenment, this is the scary part for those of you who don't understand it. For those of you who don't understand it, oh, it's such a relief, is that when you become still, your sense of existence, your sense of being, vanishes. The more still you are, the less you are. The less you do, the more the being vanishes. But is counterintuitive in one sense, because as you start to fade away and vanish, you find that it's not scary at all. It's not difficult. In fact, it's happier and happier and happier. The more you disappear, the more peaceful and blissful you feel. Which is why the Buddha said, enlightenment is the highest, the ultimate happiness. That's the one which hooked me. I know all religions have to have a marketing slogan. You know, Christianity sometimes is, if you don't believe, you go to hell. Ever. Permanent. And describe all the things which happen down here. That has been a very effective marketing slogan. Fear. However, the Buddhist marketing slogan is happiness. And more happiness. And even extreme happiness. And sometimes you see monks and nuns, teachers or whatever, who exhibit that. That's one of the reasons I stay with someone like Ajahn Chah. You meet all these people. Now, see, you met Nobel laureates in Cambridge. Sometimes you met some really rich people. There was one Viscount, sort of, I knew over there. There was, in our college, it was a sports college, Majid Khan, who played cricket for Pakistan, a famous cricketer, and all these amazing, famous guys, which you met, some millionaires. But you go and see this guy who just completed grade 4 at school, hadn't a cent to his name, and you know, he won the happiness stakes outright. If there was, you know, like you have like Miss Universe, if you have like Mr. Arahat competition, and get all the monks, which you know, and you know, you as lay people, ask them a few questions, test them out, and vote to see who is the Arahat of the year, Ajahn Chah would have won it hands down. So when you actually saw someone, you know, who was really happy and at peace, that was impressive. And he didn't just, you know, when he was on show, because you hang around, went on arms round with him, sort of washed his clothes, you saw him all the time, and you know, you're always looking for a chink in his smile. Sometimes he'd get really upset or angry at you for something, but you never saw that. About 8 or 9 years, so there was a real happy person. And you realize that that's what I want, to be happy, like that. Not just the happiness, you know, when your football team wins the final. You can see people like that, jumping up and down, and next minute sort of getting drunk because they're fed up, they don't know what to do next. Not just the happiness, when you fall in love, when you met your soulmate for the future, and you think we're going to be happy ever after. Yeah, come on, you all know that. Maybe 1 or 2 years and that's done. But, it's true, isn't it? Come on. Be real. Oh, that type of happiness isn't nice, but something which is really solid, because it's a happiness which doesn't depend on somebody else, or, you know, having this or getting that. A happiness which is independent of everything. When you actually see that, and you read what the Buddha called, the enlightenment is the highest happiness, you say, okay, I can understand what that means now. Not some sort of mystical statement which is really hard to understand, but something which is real, which you can see, which you can test, which you can feel. So, that to me was the best description of enlightenment. Ultimate happiness. And then once you saw that, how do you get from this place where I was to this ultimate happiness? What's the ladder? What's the road, the path? You can't just suddenly say, I'm going to be enlightened and become happy. And then you actually saw this great path, you know, called the Eightfold Path. And that Eightfold Path is the path towards enlightenment. And anyone who comes and said, no, Satipatthana is the only way, or Samatha is the only way, or sort of believing in the great white ram is the only way, whatever else people think is the only way, it's the Eightfold Path. And now, just before the Buddha passed away, someone asked him this great question, the sort of question I would hope you would have asked, you know, the monks and nuns last night. Now, one of those really tricky ones, but the tricky ones, the reason why they're tricky is because they're really trying to open up a new area of understanding. And the tricky question they asked the Buddha was, can people become enlightened in other religions other than Buddhism? Or other than, you know, your particular type of Buddhism? That's a great question to ask. Can people become enlightened if they are not members of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, following the true Buddhist tradition? We all think we've got the best tradition. But the Buddha gave, like usual, this amazing answer, which was just not a yes or no, but which actually opened up sort of areas which a questioner never believed would be revealed to them. And the Buddha's answer, simple but very effective, was wherever you find the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you'll find enlightened beings. It doesn't matter what the name of the religion is. It doesn't matter what colour robes people wear. It doesn't matter what you chant or what statue you have behind you or no statue. It doesn't matter what books you have and what books you read and what understanding of those books, whether you know Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan or whatever. That's not the point. It's what you do. Because the Buddha was saying, if you follow these instructions, doesn't matter what you think they're called, then it leads to enlightenment. Cause and effect. If you make these causes, that's what happens afterwards. It's like a science of enlightenment. Well tried, well worn, always happens if you follow that path. So what is that path? First of all, virtue. That's why we have precepts. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. So, you know, be someone who never harms yourself or others. The basics of virtue. Why do you want to drink, take drugs? Complete waste of time. Why do you want to cheat people? That just hurts them. You want to kill things. It doesn't make you feel good, it doesn't make anyone else feel good. I was very fortunate in my life. I remember that when I was about 10 or 11 year old, I got fascinated with fishing. And I was begging my mother and father, can I get a fishing rod for my birthday? I want a fishing rod for my birthday, because it was romantic to go fishing. And I was pestering them so much, eventually came my birthday, gave me a fishing rod. I had a fishing rod! Now I can go fishing. So I now had to badger my parents to take me, because, you know, in Acton, in London, there's no actually lakes or rivers to go fishing in. You go to the River Thames, it's all dead because all the pollution in there. The only thing you can fish out is an old tin can. But after badgering my parents, we finally went out into the country to a fishing place. Now this is how much great good karma I have from the past. My grandfather went with me, and he was going to teach me how to fish. And so he got the rod and he cast out the line and it got caught in a tree. And he yanked the rod and it broke. Oh, I was so mad at my grandfather. I knew how to go at it. And he was supposed to be the expert. And at the time I was so angry, but now, oh, that must have been Davis did that to protect me from making bad karma. I had a very fortunate upbringing. So now, thank you grandfather, for being stupid. But you know, for a young boy that was just devastating, but nevertheless, there's so many stories from your life. Nevertheless, good karma is necessary for enlightenment. And if you want to know from experience why that's necessary, I mentioned, when you meditate, you'll find some of the energy of your meditation. The ability to get peaceful very quickly depends upon the purity of your mind. And if you have been angry, negative, especially recently, you know, you've been selfish, you know, you've got into the breakfast and there's only one croissant left. It's mine. Keep your hands off it. Whatever it is you like. That's the sort of stuff which ruins your meditation. Try that. Now, if it's only one croissant left and you see someone else trying to be greedy, here you have it. And then you get good meditation. It's easy, because you're letting go. You're not worried about your tummy. So little acts of purity like that, it's amazing just how that powers your meditation. So you can check that out. Every time, you know, you're selfish, greedy, you know, angry at someone for making a noise, you ruin your meditation. You're taking away your power. So the purity, the virtuous practices. And then you do have, you know, the energy, the mindfulness, the stillness. They all sort of work together. The right intention, which I mentioned a lot, being kind, being gentle, letting things be. The three right intentions. As far as the right view is concerned, the right understanding. There is understanding, just the cause and effect process, the that to let go is a way to be peaceful. After a while, all these things come together. It's a path. And so anyone who practices that path, it doesn't matter sort of what they call themselves or, you know, what they think they are. If you do that path, it leads to enlightenment. So what does it lead to? Great stillness. The purpose of virtue is getting a powerful mind. You've got no unfinished business with other people or with yourself. You know what happens when you make a mistake, you upset somebody. It's a lot of business fixing up that mistake. When you're kind to someone, it doesn't leave unfinished business. Every time you're virtuous and kind to yourself and others, it actually makes life more peaceful for you and for others. It gives you more opportunity to let go when you've got less things, less burdens, less worries, less guilt to carry around with you. It frees you to become still. The stillness, I made a lot of this. Samadhi means stillness. Because when you become still, it's like, again, like the lake being still. When there's not a wave on the surface. And if you've ever gone to the mountains and seen these mountain lakes, where because the big hills stop all the wind coming, they're glassy smooth. And people love seeing the very smooth lakes because it's a metaphor for something very deep. Because when the lake is smooth, it perfectly reflects the hills, the sky, and maybe even the moon shining above. But one ripple, one little wave on that lake, and it will distort the image. When the lake is smooth, then you can see real insight, a perfect reflection of what surrounds the lake, what embraces it, what's above. Perfect reflection, perfect insight. One of the other similes of why stillness is essential. In that stillness, craving is finished for a while. You understand, oh, this is what it means for the end of craving, this is what it feels like. As I mentioned quite a few times on this retreat, why do you crave? Craving is promising you something. But it's always unfaithful to what it promises. If it does reach that, you want something more. But the craving itself destroys what you truly want, which is peace. And when you end craving, you find everything which I wanted to crave for, the whole purpose of craving, is achieved when I stop craving. Why have you been working so hard? Why have you been struggling and striving so hard in your life? Going to work, studying, really trying to do the very, very best thing. Why? What are you trying to get from all of this? And you find when you let go of craving, you find what you really wanted all the time. Just peace and freedom. Love. Unconditional. Just being. Not moving. Rest. Peace of mind. The home at the end of the journey. Your real home. Peace of mind. Stillness. And it's as if we've been conned all these years, all these lifetimes, to think that if we crave, 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 and if we crave smartly enough, if we're wise enough and clever enough to crave properly, then we'll get happiness. We'll get what we want. You are clever enough. You're not stupid. You tried your very best. You've been energetic enough. But still you haven't really got what you wanted. When you stop craving, I already had what I wanted. And I threw it away because craving promised me I'd get something. I had it already. Peace. What experience before you start craving? What's there which craving shatters and destroys? It's beautiful peace, stillness of mind. But that's not something which is a mystical statement. That's sometimes something which you can experience. And that gives you a very, very clear handle on what enlightenment is. The end of craving. Well, in this particular case, what's there before craving destroys it? Not after craving, but as it were, that experience before craving. Now, if you can understand that, you get a handle on what the end of craving is. And stillness and peace. Sure, things disappear and things fade away. But all that's disappearing and fading away is stuff which is a whole bunch of suffering anyway, which sucks. Which, you know, it's about time you let go of. Now, things like thinking. Well, the Buddha described thinking as, and this is one simile I never mentioned the other day, he said it was just like a young boy or a young girl going out to the nightclub. Really dressed up, dressed to kill. It's not exactly, again, how it says in the sutta. I wasn't going to a nightclub, but I'm just updating the old text. So they're dressed to kill, full makeup, great hairstyle, and they're going out to the nightclub, and they find that someone has just draped them with a carcass of a dead dog tied to a string around their neck. Now, if you were going out for the night and you had a carcass of a dead dog, maybe the punks might thought that was cool, but most people would think that's disgusting. A stinking, dead, rotting carcass of a dog around your neck. What would you want to do? Throw it off as soon as you can and wash yourself and get a new pair of clothes or something. And the Buddha, actually, this is his description of thinking. Like you put these stinking, useless thoughts around the beautiful mind of yours, a still, radiant, blissful, beautiful mind. Why have you done that? And after a while, these things disappear. Okay, a lot of you is gone, because we identify, we attach with being the thinking. That's who we really think we are, especially those people who are clever. Clever people, they really identify themselves with their thinking. So much so, they write books about my thoughts, you know, my struggle, Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler, or sort of the thoughts of Chairman Mao, or Opening the Door of Your Heart by Ajahn Brahm. Oops. So people get so attached to their thoughts, they want to say, these are my thoughts, what great thoughts they are, you should all read them. The bigger the ego, the bigger you attach to your thoughts. So that's why it's very tough for you to let go of your thoughts. Because you're disappearing. And that's part of the idea of non-self in Buddhism. That's another description of Nibbana, is actually seeing there's no one in here. To understand that, there's one of my favourite similes. Which is a simile of the driverless bus. Now, when I actually wrote that, the Mindfulness Bliss and Beyond, they wanted to cut that simile out, the editors. And I said, no way. Because that's one of my favourite similes. And the driverless bus goes like this. Life is a journey. That's a famous metaphor. But this one is a bus journey. Not sort of on Buddha Air, but Buddha Wheels. I don't know what you call the transport company. But on your bus journey, which is your life, sometimes your bus goes through beautiful scenery, rolling hills and meadows and tranquil streams and waterfalls and beautiful scenery. You know, sometimes life is like that. You're having a wonderful time. Everything is just so nice. And so you ask your bus driver, which is your Will. That's his name, Mr. Will. Will for short. So you tell Will, slow down. Even stop, please. I want to enjoy this. Because this is the most wonderful time of your life. Beautiful scenery. And what does your bus driver do? Puts his foot down on the accelerator and speeds out. Have you ever noticed that in life? The really wonderful times don't last as long as they should. And then later on, the bus driver is going through this devastated, toxic waste dump of life. You know, the remnants of a nuclear power plant which exploded, where there's nothing alive, where everything is toxic, where everything stinks and is repulsive. And when you go through those areas, what do you tell your bus driver? Rush out of here. Speed away. I don't want to stay in here much longer. And that represents the painful, disappointing, now the ugly part of life, which we all have to experience from time to time. So you tell the bus driver, get out of here. Come on, Will. get out of this pain, this disappointment, this anger, this grief. Get out quick. And what does a bus driver do? Goes down the gears, stops and parks. And you're parked in grief for I don't know how many years. And come on, get out of here. Will, he's just going to have a cup of tea. He just won't drive the car at all. And this is, you know, the unpleasantness of life does last longer than it should, so many people think. And so that's why you come to Buddhist centers, churches, philosophies, to try and get more control over your life. So the happiness can last longer. And the unhappiness, you can find these little tricks so you don't have to feel so much pain. Or you can do something so the pain has disappeared, so you can hang out in jhana and have a wonderful time. Anything to control your happiness and your suffering, to get more of one and less of the other. Basically, people try and train their will. Not just with the force of their will, but with the skill and the wisdom. So the will gets very sneaky. So you can actually always avoid, by your own choice, the unpleasantness of life. And you can work it through your will and your sort of cleverness to stay in your happy places as long as you possibly can. That is not what Buddhism is all about. That's just creating more will. Because you find that so frustrating, it never works. You come on retreats and you're still hurt. You sort of go to philosophy, you learn yoga, you do Kabbalah like Madonna or whatever else she does, and she's still suffering just as much. Doesn't matter how smart you think you are, and everyone thinks they're smart. One of the tricks, if you're giving a public talk, one of the very nice little speaking tricks is to ask your audience, how many of you think you are above average intelligence? Put your hand up if you think you're above average intelligence. And about 3/4 of people put their hand up, and the other quarter are half asleep, or maybe fully asleep. But the point is, everybody, 99% of people, think they're above average intelligence, and half of those must be wrong. Only half of people can be above average intelligence, but we always think that we're in that half, don't you? Be honest about it. So you always think that you're smart enough to sort of get out of the problems other people face. Now this is the delusion of the ego. This is the conceit of the ego, thinking you're clever. And so you use your cleverness with your will to try and avoid suffering. But the driverless bus, similarly, is you've done that so many times, it hasn't worked. Because your will is just so stupid. Talking about a bad bus driver, your will, no, it's the worst of the worst. So what people want to do next, they want to find this will and teach it a lesson. You know, to tell your will, look, stop being so stupid. How many times have I told you, you know, to let go this way? And sort of, you know, to don't keep struggling and give yourself a break when you want to go to bed, just go to bed and stop worrying about it, Ajahn Brahm said. How many times does Ajahn Brahm have to tell you, will? So before you can really, you know, sort out your will and teach it properly, you've got to find your will first of all. And that's when you get up from the seat in your bus and you go searching around for where the bus driver's seat is. Where does will live? Your will, your choice, your doer. And you go searching all around your bus. This is what the path of meditation is. And finally you find the bus driver's seat. You find your will, the bus driver, or at least his seat, because in this deep meditation, you get one of the great enlightening shocks of your life. You find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's nobody sitting in your bus. It's on almost automatic pilot. When you find there's nobody in your bus driving it, something very important happens. You just go sitting back in your seat, nice territory, unpleasant territory, you stop complaining. There's no one to complain to anymore. Waste of time shouting at the driver when there's no one there. You stop getting angry at yourself and others. You stop craving. Waste of time craving. No one's listening. I want, I want, I want. No one's listening. It's not going to make any effect. So when you see your bus driver's seat is empty, you end craving and ill will. Nice territory, unpleasant territory, just par for the course. You stop worry and craving. Peace at last. That's a simile of the bus driver's seat. But sometimes it's hard to get to that bus driver's seat. Hard to find it. So there's another simile. And this is another original Ajahn Brahm simile, which is even my most favourite simile of enlightenment. Even more favourite than the bus driver's empty seat. And many of you know this is an old classic of the donkey and the carrot. The donkey and the carrot simile works like this. You all know donkeys, and actually somebody was offering a couple of donkeys to our monastery. Now with them as well, if they became a nun or a monk or whatever. So, the donkeys that most people know are supposed to be very stubborn. Maybe if you know you can talk with them and get to know them and love them, they will help you. But most donkeys are very stubborn, so traditionally, to get a donkey to move, you'd have to tie a stick to their back. The front of the stick is about 2 feet in front of their head. On the end of a stick is a string. On the end of the string is a carrot. So the donkey won't move if you hit it, or if you shout at it. But there's a nice juicy carrot in front, then the donkey would move. Just the same as you. I could hit you, I could shout at you, but that won't make you meditate. When I put a bit of a carrot in front of you, they're nimitters, bliss better than sex. Yeah, okay, I'm going to move for that. So that's my juicy carrot. So the donkey's got a carrot in front of it. And what does the donkey do? So it ignites that carrot, it moves towards the carrot. But of course, the carrot's on a string, which is attached to a stick, which is attached to the donkey's back. So when the donkey moves, so does the carrot. But the donkey doesn't give up. It keeps moving, trying to chase that carrot. Even if the donkey runs, the carrot runs the same speed in front of it. So the poor old donkey is tricked into putting the cart full of people or full of produce, and that's how they get donkeys to move. And that's how you get you to move. Now, why do you go to work anyway? You've got this lovely carrot of your salary. But is it ever enough? Sometimes the salary is not quite enough. Because if it was enough, you'd be able to eat that carrot and you wouldn't have to work anymore. But just a little bit more to keep you working next week and next week and next week. All your life is chasing a carrot. Sometimes we have the carrot of relationships. When you find somebody and they're almost a perfect person, so they're not quite, so you give them away and try for another carrot. And always thinking that the perfect one is just about to come. Going back to that Mullah Nasruddin from the Islamic tradition, really wise, great sayings there, that once Mullah Nasruddin was sitting in front of a big pile of chilies, red hot chilies, you know the chilies? And he was eating one after another. And even if I ate one, I'd be red with my nose streaming. And he'd eaten, I don't know how many so far, and his face was red, his eyes were streaming with tears, and snot was coming down from his nose. You know what happens when you eat too many chilies? And his friend said, "What are you doing that for? Why are you suffering so much?" And Nasruddin's answer was, "I'm looking for the sweet one." That's brilliant wisdom. So why are you meditating so much for? Suffering in pain. Why? Because you're waiting for the sweet one. That's what happens in life, isn't it? So remember, chilies aren't sweet chilies. They're all hot and they make you suffer. So be careful what you really want. So a lot of times this donkey racing up, trying to get the carrot, but never getting it, always getting the hot, the bad stuff. But many of you know that the donkey carts, they used to be very common in Southern Europe. However, about 30, 40 years ago, give or take 30 or 40 years, Buddhism came to Europe, and especially Southern Europe. And once the donkeys learnt about Dhamma, they didn't need to actually follow the carrot anymore. They learnt how to catch the carrot. And this is how the Buddhist donkey, in this case, you, the Buddhist donkey, catches the carrot. What the donkey does, it's been following that carrot for so many years and never can quite get it. It's always 2 feet in front. Nimitters, you can see them, but you can't really catch them. jhanas, peace, whatever, it's almost there, but you go towards it and it goes away from you, it disappears. So what the Buddhist donkey does, it runs like hell after that carrot. Top speed. Does that do anything? Of course not yet. Because that carrot is always 2 feet in front. But the Buddhist donkey knows how to stop. That's all a Buddhist donkey needs to do. To stop. Once you stop trying and craving and wanting things, what happens? The carrot goes even further away. That's what happens sometimes when people let go. Their mind is in sloth and torpor. Oh, they're restless. That's what happens when you first try this method. The carrot, whatever you want, goes further away. But you are patient. Wait for a while. Because soon that carrot is 4 feet in front of your mouth. Twice the distance. Further away than it's ever been before. And that's when sometimes people stop doing this method and they start trying again. Stupid. So, be patient, because it goes 4 feet away and then something strange happens. For the first time in your life, the carrot starts moving towards you. It starts moving towards you. When you start letting go, really being peaceful, you know, not doing things, just sitting there, sloth and torpor, after a while sloth and torpor vanishes. All this restlessness and thought is gone. Peace is coming towards you. Nimitta has come towards you. Jhana comes towards you. In a short time, that carrot's his usual place, 2 feet in front, but now coming towards you at great speed. And what do you need to do? Just sit there. Do nothing. When the carrot comes close enough, you must always remember compassion. The door of my mouth is open to you, carrot. Thank you very much. Nibbana. That's how enlightenment happens. When you go chasing for things, no way, because that's just craving, that's doing, you're stirring things up. Your job is to stop, to be still, and enlightenment comes towards you. That's sweet. Now you can maybe understand the method. You can also understand a bit more what enlightenment is, the end of craving. You vanish it. What's the big thing about you anyway? The sooner you get out of the way of samsara, the better. What are you really sort of afraid of losing anyway? Afraid of losing your will? You know what will is like. It just causes you a lot of problems. I call will the torturer, the prison guard. It was always ordering you around. The boss in your mind. Come on, do this. Come on, do that. Don't do it this way. Don't do it that way. You stupid. You did it the wrong way. That's what the will is. It's like a prison guard who never gives you a moment's peace. Have a think of that. Contemplate it. And you find that which you cherished and thought was essential to you is actually the source of so much pain. Your will. If you just let it go and be still, you find out, wow, that's exactly what it's like. And it's much better if I just let it be and disappear and vanish. And you understand why we call Nibbana just the vanishing act. Cessation, disappearing, gone. So there's much more to say about Nibbana, but as usual I've run out of time. But nevertheless, I've given you enough information. And you see, it's not mystical stuff, this is practical down to the earth, which you can understand, which makes sense, but now you have to go and experience it for yourself. See if you can find your bus driver's seat, and I guarantee there'll be no one there. And you'll find that's such a great relief. See if you can stop chasing the carrot and just sit there. If you do that 100%, and sometimes you can do that 100%, when your back's against the wall, you've got no other choice but to let go. If you can do that, stop rushing around and stop. Then all these wonderful things happen for you. You can't do it. You have to get out of the way, and it happens by itself. That's why you know what Nirvana means. It's a flame going out. I mentioned this is a very important point. In the time of the Buddha, every little kid walking down the street, girl and boy, would understand what Nirvana meant. It was a word in common usage. It was not something reserved for philosophers. Everybody knew the meaning of that word. It was a word used when the flame of a candle went out. The candle flame went out, it literally nibbana'd. So the little kid would say, "Mummy, the flame is nibbana'd again. Light it, Johnny." That was all it would mean. A flame gone out. And the Buddha used that as the word for enlightenment. The flame, you, gone out. And sometimes there was one guy, Vajragotha, actually asked the Buddha, "What happens? Where do you go when you're enlightened? Do you go to some great retirement home of you, where you can live happily ever after? Is that what Nibbana is? The ultimate old people's home? Where you can sit and watch whatever movie you want to watch, and have whatever sex you want, or whatever." Actually, that's a joke. I can't resist telling this joke. It's a bit of a naughty joke. But nevertheless, maybe I shall turn this off, and no, I won't, because people know. I'm trying to lose my reputation. About that old lady who went into the retirement home. No, she's in the retirement home. Went into the lounge where all the old men were sitting watching the TV. And she held her hand up, her fist, and said, "If anyone can guess what I have in my fist, they can have sex with me tonight." And an old man in the corner in the back said, "An elephant." And she said, "Close enough." That's what happens when you get old. It's a very funny joke. It just shows craving never stops when you get old. Stupidity as well. Anyway, I don't know why I said that in the talk on the bottom. But anyone who criticised me, it's not my fault. I'm not going to blame my bus driver. There's no one in here. So you can blame my bus driver as much as you want. Will is not in here. He's gone away. So, when you understand how to let go, how to be at peace, get a great time. You can be absolutely happy. I think I better stop there before I make more. So thank you very much for listening to the talk of Nibbana. And hopefully you can get somewhere in Nevada. And now we have interviews. And remember...